Saddam Hussein were to give members of al-Qaeda any sort of weapons, they would use those weapons on Saddam Hussein.
Where the Democrats really lost is, what do they stand for?
There were 12 of us that were trying to get into the Senate building to address the Senate to not vote in favor of this war resolution to go to war against Iraq.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, November 6th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It's one day after President Bush and the GOP orchestrated one of the most stunning political sweeps in a midterm election, and Democrats are left licking their wounds. We begin our coverage with a review of the election results as it relates to the Iraq factor. In other words, what was the political cost to politicians who refused to back the president's war agenda? Eric Gustafson is with EPIC, Educators for Peace in Iraq Center. We spoke with him earlier today. Eric, what happened? The Democrats took a royal trouncing. Was it something they said about Iraq?
I mean, I think the question and where the Democrats really lost is, what do they stand for? You know, when it comes to national security, what do they stand for? They allowed the Republicans to control the message. And with the war vote, I think clearly when you have Senator Max Cleland in Georgia, you have Senator Carnahan in Missouri, lose because the liberal base failed to turn out to the polls, bottom line. And they voted the wrong way when it came to the war vote. So I'm not going to say that it was the one issue that decided those outcomes, but it clearly contributed to turnout for the Democrats, turnout for their liberal base. And I think the Democrats need to have a vision, and they need to stand for something, just as Senator Wellstone stood for something.
Well, I think their vision is to basically try and be as middle of the road as possible. But pundits were all over the map on whether supporting the president's war resolution was going to be a plus or a minus on the campaign trail. Do we assume today, after the biggest GOP midterm victory in decades, that voting against the war resolution was not a politically smart thing to do? Or was the problem that Democrats draped themselves around the Republican president at a time when Democrats were desperately looking for a difference between the two parties?
I think that the Democrats should have taken a position in support of national security, but against the president on a war in Iraq. And by failing to do so, by becoming accommodationists, they didn't appear to stand for anything. And as a result, you know, it turned off a lot of voters that could have turned out to help reelect those incumbents that lost and to help upset some of the other races.
Well, apparently the Iraq factor wasn't that big a factor for the majority of Americans in the elections yesterday.
The problem is that because the leadership of the Democrats did not stand up against the president on the war vote, that I think hurt turnout at the polls for Democrats. And I think it was a factor. It's not the only factor. I mean, it also has to do with, you know, the fact that the Democrats haven't come strongly out against the tax cut. They haven't been real strong on other issues. So, you know, I think what we're going to start to see is, what I hope will happen is you'll start to see Pelosi and others take on more of the leadership of the Democratic Party, because clearly Gephardt and Daschle are the real losers in this election.
And weren't they the ones standing behind the president in the Rose Garden when the president was pushing for his war resolution in Congress?
Absolutely. And they allowed the Republicans to own the message rather than having a message of their own. I want to kind of touch on something else. You know, the ballots aren't even cold, and already I've just gotten news that there are three large ships filled with tanks that just set sail from San Diego to the Gulf, loaded with weapons, with tanks. This is the equipment for the 3rd Infantry Division based out of Fort Stewart, Georgia. 3rd Infantry Division had been the 24th Infantry Division, which was the first unit that deployed to the Gulf in 1990, leading up to the 91 Gulf War. This is a very bad sign. I mean, I think that already we have a president that is out of control. He's been emboldened. And I think that this administration is going to, in many respects, treat this election as a referendum in favor of a war in Iraq. So we've returned to the days of Richard Nixon. Mm. You know, I mean, I think we're going to see an increase in U.S. interventions around the world, and it will start with a major war in Iraq, which I really do fear is going to actually backfire. It will undermine our national security.
Eric Gustafson is with EPIC, Educators for Peace in Iraq Center. With Republicans taking control of the U.S. Senate away from the Democrats and increasing the number of seats in the House of Representatives, and of course already being in the White House, the balance of power has tilted heavily to the right. All this during a time when the economy is faltering, unemployment is high, and the president wants to take the country into war. How much of a factor was the war? How much of a factor was Iraq? Did Democratic politicians miscalculate the cost? What went wrong? What went right? And do we need to fix it? Our next segment is an in-depth discussion with U.S. Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton of the District, Gerald Horn, Professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen. In the aftermath of yesterday's election, we thought it would be prudent to review the body politics as it relates perhaps to the Iraq factor within this election. Anyone care to weigh in on exactly what happened yesterday?
Congresswoman Norton, most of the Democrats voted against the majority resolution that would have sent the president straight into Iraq. And indeed, he only came to here and to the UN because there was a lot of pressure on him from us and others. But the president, it seems to me, did something that was very deliberate. I'm not saying his heart wasn't in it and he doesn't believe it, but the fact is, for the months preceding the election, he succeeded in changing the subject entirely from his weak point, which is the economy, to the strong point of any president during time of war. Now, he couldn't do that with the Homeland War because all of the evidence was that Americans were beginning to feel more relaxed about it. But he certainly could raise the Homeland War issue by trying to talk about another danger, a danger that he never showed to be a clear and present danger, and a danger which he introduced by coming forward with a radical new doctrine of preemption, whereby the president on his own, without coming to Congress, could attack other countries.
Mm. You said most of the Democrats voted against the war resolution?
That is right, 58%.
That's in the House, if I recall, because, of course...
And that is in the House, and I'm a member of the House.
Okay. Yes, in the U.S. Senate, of course, the vote was 77-23.
Paul Loeb?
And considering that there were at least 49 Democrats in the Senate at the time of that vote, that probably means that a majority of the Democrats in the Senate voted for the resolution. That includes top-level Democrats like Tom Daschle, for example, the Senate leader, and high-profile Democrats like Hillary Rodham Clinton of the state of New York. And certainly I think that the Democrats were not able to project a consistent message in light of the fact that Democratic leader Dick Gephardt also voted for the resolution and certain sense broke with his caucus on that.
Yeah.
And I think that in light of the fact that the Democrats were reluctant to make Bush's tax cuts to the wealthy a major issue, in light of the fact that now defeated Democrats like Max Cleland of Georgia and Jean Carnahan of Missouri voted for those tax cuts, and because they can present a consistent message on the war in light of that vote in the U.S. Senate, it provided a muddled message, and therefore it helped to suppress turnout, particularly amongst African-American voters in the South, which of course are key the Democratic chances nationally, and I think that that's a key helping to explain what appears to be, at this point, a GOP sweep in both houses of Congress. And, of course, Congresswoman Norton is absolutely correct in pointing to President Bush's adroit manipulation of this question of war, helping to change the subject away from plummeting consumer confidence and rising unemployment and a corporate crime wave of historic proportions. On the other hand, of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that in the state of California, of course, the Democrats were able to hold back the tide, and the Republican Party is basically on life support in that important state. And certainly on the gubernatorial level, Democrats were able to not only prevail in California, but in Illinois and Michigan and a number of other very key important states like Pennsylvania. And in light of the Republican line of devolving power back to the states through this policy of so-called new federalism of states' rights, and in light of the fact that even the new campaign finance reform that was enacted basically puts power back to the state parties and takes it away from the national parties, it seems to me that's going to complicate the Republican Party efforts to prevail going forward.
Professor Gerald Horn. Now, Paul Loeb, did you want to respond?
Building on what Professor Horn said, one of the things that I found really disturbing, and it echoes 1994, is that to me the Democrats really, I really admire the folks who stood up against Bush, and it was half the House and over half the House and almost half the Senate, but they really fell into Bush's trap by, instead of drawing a line and saying, look, this is what we stand for, you know, even doing something very pragmatic like saying, wait, let's see how the inspections fare and let's revisit this in February so that it would be off the table as an election issue. What they ended up doing is going ahead with a vote that A, left the ones who opposed Bush vulnerable to attacks, and B, even more importantly, left the ones who caved to Bush absolutely demoralizing their base. And I saw that just from the emails I got, because I did a piece saying, I know that this makes us extremely angry. We should be extremely angry. Nonetheless, we can't allow the Senate and the House to be handed over to the Republicans. We still need to be able to volunteer and vote. And I got all these emails back saying, why? I mean, you know, just why should we? And what happened, I think, I saw this in 94. I was touring. It was right after NAFTA, which really fractured the Democratic coalition. And I was touring all over the country on a previous book. And everywhere, long-standing Democratic volunteers were staying home and not getting helping get that turnout out. And that's part of what happened in the Gingrich sweep. And I think, I mean, we're still sorting through, obviously, exactly what did and didn't happen in the election most recently. But my sense is that the turnout was low, that the volunteer levels were low, that the Democratic base was demoralized. And when you're talking about elections that are decided by, you know, Carnahan's case, what, something like 20,000 votes, Mondale's, and then Norm Coleman, 40,000 votes, that makes a huge difference. And one of the things that I think is critical is that there's a kind of, and we have to be the people who make the case for it, that there's a conjoining of pragmatism and morality, I think, that the Democrats need to see, which is it is not pragmatic to cave and cave and cave and cave and cave to Bush and hope that he's going to implode. It's also obviously not moral. And that, in fact, the path of standing up and really fighting on some of these issues turns out to be the more pragmatic path as well.
Let me intervene from the Congress for a second on that, because I agree with the essential analysis of my two friends here. But as a progressive Democrat, I must tell you, the whole notion that the pragmatic cost for example, the members of the Senate or the members of the House who stood with the war was simply to stand up against it, really fails to understand what the pressure has been on them. And there's no question in my mind.
Oh, it's real, sure. Yeah.
It's so real that if you look at Georgia, for example, the notion that he could have won by standing up, I mean, they attacked him on Homeland Security. I mean, understand where I was in the war. I was very angry about the war. I was angry about the war because I regarded as Bush, looking to Bush 1, realizing that what happened to his father was the war had gone from the picture. Economy was in the picture, so he couldn't let that happen to him, so put war back in the picture. My analysis here is not yours, that, you know, if we just stood up with tax cuts, many of my colleagues couldn't possibly stand up on tax cuts, given what all the data show, couldn't possibly stand up on Iraq. But we did have an alternative. And the first alternative was to find a way to break through the bully pulpit. And when the president has the bully pulpit, that is very difficult, but that's what our leadership should have done, so as to make the economy, which is a real issue, which was a real issue in Republican and Democratic districts, and we did not do that. Instead, we allowed the president for 6 months to talk about the war. We talked about it, too. We didn't find ways to get out into the country. We didn't find ways to actualize this economy. What was said about African-American turnout and suppressing our vote is exactly correct. We didn't pay attention to the dissonance in our own party. I don't think the answer is to say that people would have lost their seats. Mm. You get up and you vote against tax cuts. The answer was to make the economy a natural democratic issue, 401ks going down the drain, unemployment up dramatically, poverty up dramatically, to somehow make that real. Those were alternatives. Our leadership didn't do it. Our party didn't do it, and we lost for not doing it.
Okay, we heard some of those sentiments from callers this morning into a local community comment line on the Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington. We have some of those comments now.
My comment is I'm just sorry that the Republicans didn't win all, everything, because I think that the country needs that to happen to them so they can really see the light. Right now, people are complacent. And they don't really think enough about voting to pull the situation in line as it should be. So the Republicans should win, and then maybe we'll have a real revolution in this country.
Anybody care to comment on that?
No, I can't agree with that. I mean, I think it's going to be bad enough as it is. But having said that, it seems to me that all is not lost. After all, in the U.S. Senate, it basically takes a two-thirds majority to really be able to work your will, to exert your will, and it seems to me that if, and this is a big if, the Democratic Party wants to fight, they can still tie up many things in the Senate and provide some kind of damage limitation. Secondly, it seems to me the Democratic Party needs to look at its leadership. I mean, for example, Terry McAuliffe had a very difficult time making the case against corporate corruption, not least because he was implicated in some of these deals, such as the WorldCom deal. And you might recall that he won a bruising internal battle for leadership of that party over Maynard Jackson. And it seemed at the time to many of us, including myself, that this was thumbing the black base in the eye by turning down Maynard Jackson, the former popular Democratic Party mayor of Atlanta, a black man, of course. And so it seems to me the Democratic Party might want to revisit the question of leadership. And that includes, of course, Dick Gephardt, who voted for the war, and Tom Daschle, who also voted against the war. It seems to me that those who, perhaps for good reason, said that the Greens were responsible for Bush's election in 2000 need to turn that same kind of critique against the Democratic Party leadership.
Well, is the system broke? Does the Democratic and Republican, does this two-party system reflect the interests and concerns of the masses of Americans when only one-third of the eligible electorate turned out to vote?
No, it does not. Yeah. But it's not because there's any viable third party on the scene. There is a third party on the scene, and I predict that third party will become the majority even in my lifetime, and that is independence. One of the reasons that both parties have problems, and by the way, Republicans meld into Democrats, if you will notice the way all the trends go, and Democrats meld into Republicans, is that essentially Democrats do not determine elections and Republicans do not determine elections. They're both minority parties. The growing party are these amalgam of citizens who belong to no party and are independents. And in any election, even mildly close, members here will play to the independents. And if you look strategically at whether they have any choice, I'm not sure they do. It is a terrible dilemma, and we've got to find our way out of it. And the whole notion, find your way out of it, just get up and say you're a Democrat and you're for what Eleanor Holmes Norton is for, which is what progressive Democrats have always stood for. Clearly is not the answer, because independents won't go for what I've always stood for. It's a far more complicated answer than that. I agree. Also, we've got to hold our leadership accountable, and we've got to find a way to break through this. We haven't done it yet.
There's also the largest party still, which is the party of non-voters.
Paul Loeb,
the two-thirds of Americans. And what I see happening is a demoralization, because they don't feel like their interests are being spoken to. And again, I also see when the Democrats demoralize their base and don't galvanize it, then it's much harder for them to turn out those non-voters, because it really does take sustained grassroots efforts. And I think that's what's been eroding. And I mean, I say this as somebody who's volunteered in campaigns every election for the last 30 years. And without that, the Democrats lose, because they're never going to be able to compete on the money front.
Well, in the state of California, for example, third parties, independent parties, basically got a historic amount of votes in yesterday's elections. They got 13% of the vote, the largest since 1913. The Green Party candidate statewide for governor got 5% of the vote, got double digits in some of the most populous counties in Northern California. It seems to me that this is going to be the growing trend, not least because there is a justifiable dissatisfaction with the muddled message that came out of the Democratic Party.
Well, let me disagree. Because California is the last place you ought to cite, because you had two obnoxious candidates. I think that what we've got, if we look at who the non-voters are poor people,
right?
They are black people, They are Hispanic people, they're other people of color, and they're lower middle class people. I think that what our party has to do, and these people will be Democrats, I'm not worried that they're going to be greens, blues, or purples. If we can do what we have not done, because my party was way into money, way into getting money because in order to get things on television. If we will do what the American labor movement has begun to do, and I must say did with some considerable success in 2000, which is do your work on the ground, do what is really very painful work, but work that not simply as an issue matter addresses these folks. Believe me, as somebody who deals with poor people in my district every time, simply going to them and saying, you know, we're going to do something about poverty, I've got a bill in that would, in fact, help you get a house is not going to do it. We have got to engage those voters door by door, register to them,
absolutely,
bring them out. They will be Democrats. And if we do that, they are so overwhelmingly Democrats, we will be able to do whatever we want to do, and our people will not be so beholden to the independents.
So can somebody tell those progressive Americans who may be feeling deflated and disempowered today why they should continue down this path of two-party politics?
I think because if we don't, matters get worse. And there's no, I mean, to the notion that somehow a third party is going to somehow create a total realignment, I mean, that hasn't happened in 160, you know, since the collapse of the Whigs, essentially, and their emergence of the Republicans. I mean, it's just very unlikely that that's going to occur. But I think that, I mean, as all I was saying, I mean, if in fact we try and focus on bringing in the base, but also, I mean, there's all other ways to challenge the sort of less progressive Democrats. I mean, not to go back to California, but there was a congressional seat where the labor movement and the other progressive forces joined together, ousted a very regressive Democrat, put in, I think it was Hilda Solis, a very, you know, good Democrat, and in a primary campaign without running through the dilemma of splitting the vote. And then that's one model in terms of pushing the party. The other, again, I think is just making very, very clear that path, I mean, it's not just the Bush's manipulation of war on September 11th. I mean, if we look back to the very beginning of when he came office, totally tarnished, there was a cave on Ashcraft, there was a cave on the initial tax bills, and, you know, bill after bill, people, and I heard the rhetoric that said, if we, you know, just give him enough rope to hang himself, he'll hang himself, and instead, what we saw is an extraordinarily ruthless Republican machine that is, you know, whatever Bush's candle power, very, very skillful at playing the political game and at using the pulpit of the presidency, and that's not going to shift. So somehow, the only way to grab the different kind of agenda is to be able to really distinguish ourselves and raise those real issues.
Well, to respond directly to your question, Werner, I think that we're going to have to operate on two tracks. I think one track will be involved in the Democratic Party, but there's going to have to be more pressure on the leadership, on pro-war Democrats like Daschle and Gephardt to make them accountable, on corporate crime recipients like Terry McAuliffe, the chairman of the party. I mean, obviously there has to be serious work at reform in the Democratic Party. I think it's irresponsible, in fact, for progressives to try to keep telling poor people, black people, Latinos, to march to the polls and vote for the Democrats when their message is either muddled or incorrect.
Look,
at the same time, it seems to me we need to work on the third-party track. I think it would be irresponsible not to, and I think what happened in California does provide a signal. Is California in 1964 with the student rebellions at Berkeley provided a model for the rest of the country? Black Los Angeles with regard to Watts in 1965 provided a model for the rest of the country in some respects. And I think that this California election yesterday also provides a model.
Well, first of all, I couldn't disagree more, and let me tell you why. Greens, for example, who are, let us say, among the largest of the third parties, pick off progressives among the Democrats. These people could think of nothing better to do than go after Paul Wellstone. They are doing that all over the country. They pick off our folks, making it more difficult for our folks to be progressive. So if you're going to be for third parties, it seems to me you must do a strategic analysis of whether or not those third parties, in fact, promote progressive politics. And since they have decided that the easy thing to do is to pick off the most progressive Democrats, I regard such third parties is anti-progressive,
mm-hmm.
and that is one of the reasons you will not find African Americans or people of color in the least bit turned on by third parties.
Congressman,
it's a big, young white thing, and it's not the way to reform our party.
Congresswoman
Norton.
Our party
needs reform. We got to go at the leadership, but going the third party route will make things worse.
Can you address, however, Congresswoman Norton, Professor Horn's point about the fact that if the Democratic Party is not representing the interests and the views of their constituents, what do they do?
I have addressed that by saying the reason our party is not doing it is because the so-called non-voters are not registered, and our party has not put its energy into it. To realize if in fact, we went after all of the non-voters, said, you know, this next term, we're putting our money into the non-voters, that it's like 90% of those people would be Democrats, and we could change our party because we would change who the electorate is. Until we are willing to do that, all this rhetoric that we who are Democrats come out about poor people, what we're going to do for housing and health care, is just that rhetoric. We got to go after the people. The reason that everybody caters to the independents and the middle class is because they go to the polls.
Final thought. Can we assume that war won the election? The economy is faltering. The job market is uncertain at best. We've had major corporate scandals, and the ever-popular President Bush, with 55% of the American people supporting his war, rode in and saved the day for GOP candidates.
No, I think that would be an exaggeration. Certainly, if you look at the state of New York, where Governor Pataki was elected to another term, he basically tried to run as a Democrat. He was appealing to union members. He was appealing to African Americans, for example. If you look at the state of Maryland, where Republicans won the gubernatorial slot for the first time in decades, you find that Kathleen Kennedy Townsend basically handed that slot over to the Republicans on a silver platter by running an uninspired campaign, by not picking a black as a lieutenant governor, et cetera. I think if you go across the country,
she picked a Republican as a lieutenant governor, which is different from just not picking a black, I think.
Precisely. And so I think if you go across the country, I think you'll find a combination of factors that led to what appears to be this GOP victory. I say appears to be because, of course, we haven't had full reporting yet on all the snafus that have taken place in various voting booths across the country. For example, in the state of Minnesota, where all of the absentee ballots for Paul Wellstone were tossed out, and all those for Norman Coleman, the eventual Republican winner, were kept. And that was precisely the margin of victory that allowed him to defeat Walter Mondale. So I think it would be an exaggeration to suggest that war won the day. At the same time, we would be remiss if we were to ignore the fact that despite the victories of the anti-war movement, not least the tens of thousands who amassed in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco some weeks ago, there is much more work to be done by the anti-war movement if we were to limit the damage that is going to be caused by the Republican Party controlling two houses of Congress and the White House.
Jill Horn, professor of
I would certainly think that war did win the day because the president was able to nationalize the war theme, both with Iraq and Homeland Security, and we, who are Democrats, were not able to nationalize our natural theme, the economy.
But the Democrats also weren't able to nationalize the hesitation of war, which is the difference between polls that say, do you support a war in Iraq, and a majority say yes, and do you support a war in Iraq if we're doing it on our own, or if we lose 3,000 or 4,000 people, in which case a majority say no. And that so that there, in fact, was a large base of significant hesitation, I would argue, in fact, a growing base, that the campaign wasn't able to tap into at all because of the way that the Democratic leadership positioned itself. And I think that in some sense, is the real tragedy that then set the stage for so much of the other destructive things that occurred. The other thing, just in terms of the movement itself, is that we do still have significant power. I always use the example from the Nixon era where there was the point where he was threatening to use nuclear weapons on North Vietnam, and Ellsberg writes about how the targeting plans are all drawn up, everything is ready to go, and then, in fact, I write about this in Soul of a Citizen, at a certain point, there was two huge demonstrations, the moratorium decentralized throughout the country, and a couple hundred thousand people in D.C. Publicly, Nixon said, I'm watching the Washington Redskins game, I don't care what these hippies think. Privately, that convinced him not to use nuclear weapons in his own judgment, looking back, and I think that we have to recognize that part of our challenge is to be able to continue reaching out to our fellow citizens and have a voice that's so significant that even someone like a Bush hesitates to go against it. And obviously that means a lot of work left to be done.
Paul Loeb, author of Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in a Cynical Time. We were also joined by U.S. Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton from the District of Columbia and Gerald Horn, professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Thank you all for being our guests this afternoon. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be right back.